accession number 20456, Reel 1.
Brigadier Wilson, Reel 1. Can you tell me if there was a family background or history of military service?
Very much so. My grandfather was an Argyle who became colonel of the regiment. He made his name defending the Suez Canal in 1915 against the Germans, the Turks rather, and the German-Turkish thing, for which he got his KCB. And he was retired after that and became governor of Jersey. My father had, in the meantime, joined the regiment in 1905, I think, and served till 1935, becoming lieutenant colonel. Faced with that, my mother's father was a cavalryman. He was 9th and 16th Fifth Lancers. So it was rather like being in a prison. I really never felt any other urge other than to get into the army.
You never had an inclination to any civilian career as an alternative?
None. I was sent to that excellent detention barracks called Wellington College. We all went to the service.
Did you do some military training while you were at Wellington?
Very much so. I was in the ATC, yes. Sergeant, very proud of that.
Can you remember what they taught you in the OTC, what the syllabus of training was?
In the OTC? Yeah. Yes, it was really rather comprehensive. First of all, basic drill, basic use of the rifle, shooting. We also did a certain amount of minor tactics, and we had to take a written exam to get our Certificate A.
Can you remember what sort of style of tactics you were being taught while at Wellington?
Well, the style as was handed down by the then regular army. That is to say, the forms of advance guards, forms of rear guards, defensive positions, all that sort of thing. It was straight out of field service regulations.
When you were laying out defensive positions, were you thinking in terms of continuous lines of entrenchment or detached one- and two-man rifle pits?
It was basically a continuous line of entrenchments, as I remember. The one- and two-man rifle pits hadn't come in, I don't think. Not by 1934, when I went to Sandhurst. No.
How was this syllabus taught? Was it done primarily in the classroom? Was it done out in the open on the ground?
We had a retired regular lieutenant colonel and a retired regimental sergeant major. And most of our company commanders, who were our housemasters basically, had fought in the last war. So there was quite a certain amount of experience.
Did they draw directly and openly on their experience to instruct you?
Yes. Wellington thought it was rather a good ADC.
What sort of scale of tactics did you go up to? Were you confined to platoon level or company, or did you go up to battalion or above?
Well, once a year, of course, we went into a fortnight's camp, where you cooperated with Tidworth or, what's the name of that other camp near Salisbury Plain?
Bulford?
Bulford, yes. Where you had the regular army, infantry, guns, demonstration platoons, that sort of thing. And also once a year one had an enormous great field day when a whole lot of public schools appeared, and the Aldershot garrison would turn out its signal little 700 weight Austrians and tanks and things, and it was a right jolly. I can't think that any serious tactical lessons were that, but it was fun.
It is interesting, though, that you saw things like tanks and...
Oh, yes, Vickers Medium and Vickers Light and the Vickers Carlton Lloyd and guns. The little 18-pounders and 4.5-housers, horse-drawn. They were beginning to be mechanised by then.
When you were going to do an advanced contact and an attack, what would your formation normally be if you were acting?
Oh, so section V. I mean,
section V.
Yes, one worked in sections.
Did you have light machine gun in every section?
We had a bloody awful wooden representation of a Lewis gun, and the big thing was to avoid ever having to carry it. And your number two had a rattle, which he rattled when you were having fire. Exactly like a football rattle.
Do you think that what you did at the OTC at Wellington provided you with a sound basis for further military training? Was it a good foundation?
Basis, yes, sound, I'm not so sure. Certainly, it gave one an appetite for it. Yeah. I mean, we knew the structure of the infantry battalion and the infantry company and the infantry platoon pretty well.
That's basic background knowledge, isn't it?
Yes, basic background knowledge. And we could shoot. We'd been on night operations. We could get ourselves from A to B. It was a good basis, I think.
You mentioned getting from A to B. Presumably that means you studied map reading.
Yes, very much so. That came into your Certificate A exam.
And the appreciation of ground? Was that
yes, also? Yes. And drawing, panoramas, that sort of thing.
Was there a noticeable change when you went to Sandhurst?
There he is. Sandhurst was quite different.
How was it different to Wellington in its approach?
Well, I would say that, and I may be absolutely deriding it, that Sandhurst in my day turned out young officers who were smart as paint, could drill like nobody's business, and knew absolutely nothing about the army. I mean, I remember 1936 being given a lecture by a distinguished cavalry colonel in those days that the day of the horse was far from over, and all this nonsense about tanks and wireless and things really weren't bothering about. Now, that was an extreme case. The day of the horse was far from over, as we discovered later on in Burma, that the animals, you could sometimes move faster than with trucks. We learned military law. Did a higher standard of map reading. We didn't do actually, and we learned to ride, of course. I was lucky I could ride for that. We didn't do much in the way of field training.
What about the style of tactics that you were being taught at Sandhurst? Did that follow on from the Wellington?
Well, same sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, it was the tactics of the British Army at that time.
Did it go beyond the Wellington training in any significant way?
I wouldn't have said very far.
When you were given that lecture about the day of the horse still not being over, did you believe it?
No.
Why was that?
Well, because in your senior term at Sandhurst, you were allowed to specialise in certain things, and I specialised in light mechanical engineering. I had a very good workshop there, and we had chassis and things we could take to pieces, and we learned a bit about mechanical drawing. We learned a bit how to use hand tools. We were being taught by officers of the tank regiment or tank corps, it wasn't as yet, and who were enthusiasts in their own way, and so one picked that sort of thing up from them.
Did you have a clear view of how a future war was likely to be fought then, which involved mechanical?
No, I don't think we did. One never had any sort of thought. It wasn't until I went to the Staff College, or that is hard on the ground, of what you might call driving in, how to organize convoys, how to get in men in and out of trucks, how to calculate loads of supplies, that sort of thing. No, we didn't.
What about the role of potential role of air power in?
That was considered. Yes, indeed, it was very much considered. But it was, in some ways, there was this great saying: the bomber will always get through. The idea of close air support did not really come into the syllabus much. No. Had to wait another year or so for that.
Do you think that your scepticism about the role of the horse was shared by other cadets at RMC?
Well, no, because there were a whole lot of them who had joined specially to get into the British and Indian cavalry regiments. And they were convinced that, you know, their particular regiments had a role in the battlefield.
The other area in which things were happening was in the political sphere at that time, in the middle 1930s. Trouble was bubbling up in Europe. Were you aware of that at the time?
Dimly, yes. I think what, of course, brought it up was, first of all, when I was at Sandhurst, George V died. And then, of course, just after one was leaving, the business of Edward VIII. But certainly the finger was pointing much more in those days to Italy than Germany, because Italy, if you remember, was in Abyssinia, mucking around there. Germany was making nasty rumbling noises, but I don't think we knew very much, I'm talking about we, the intelligence stuff, actually what was going on in Germany.
Do you remember if there was a significant event or development that persuaded you that a war was likely or that a war was inevitable?
No, not till 1938. No, not then.
At that time, did you ever think that Japan might become an enemy?
No. No, I don't think we did. There was, of course, tremendous talk of the 5-5-3 ratios, all that sort of thing, and the various naval conferences. But I don't think we seriously considered Japan was an enemy. Russia was a menace, a big menace. But again, as an enemy, not quite, no.
Was Russia perhaps considered more of a potential source of internal dissent?
Well, yes, they might say. They might say. And there was, of course, in those days, quite a certain amount of internal politicking going on in the army, with various sort of, how can I put it, papers circulating among the boys.
About what?
What a super place the Red Army was, and how the other armies were out of date, and you know how our officers were useless, and I forget what they were called now. It was considered a very considerable offence to catch someone, you know, circulating one in the barrack room.
Do you think they had any effect on the way people were thinking?
Oh yes, I think they did. For example. One of our soldiers made his name as a battalion commander in the International Brigade in Spain and did very well. And to our disgrace, he was never accepted back in the army when the war came on. In those days, well, particularly at Willington, you now sort of trigger something off. In those days, you were either a fascist or a communist. needless to say, was a fascist, as most from Wellington. But we had, for example, the two brothers Romilly, Shakespeare's nephews, and they fought against each other in the Spanish Civil War.
That is very tragic, isn't it?
Well, I know.
Fratricidal.
Yes. Concept. Well, I mean, I think the Spanish Civil War did wake people up in a big way as to, you know, what could happen. And there really was a communist menace.
But not a fascist menace.
No, I think people were, it's a funny thing to say, Mosley wasn't considered an enemy of the people.
Was he considered misguided then rather than hostile?
Was he considered?
Misguided.
Ah, yes, I think so. Yes. But I mean, you saw these people going about in their black uniforms and medals on and so on, street definitely. They took no notice of them, you know. They were sort of on your side.
Was this because they were obviously veterans of the First World War, was that?
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Were there any sympathisers with the Bolshevik line at the Royal Military College?
None that I remember.
It sounds as though there was quite a high level of political interest at Wellington, that people were taking sides. Was Sandhurst politically active, or were the cadets inert?
I think we worked too hard. I don't somehow remember. You see, your instructors at Sandhurst were serving soldiers. Your instructors at Wellington were ordinary civilian masters. And depending on the master, so the sort of tone of the class followed.
Would it be fair to say that for you there was not really a choice of regiment, that you were destined for the Argyll and Sutherland Highlands?
Yes.
In the moment you...
Yes. And all my sort of cousins and everyone else was in it, you know. We have an enormous amount of cousins in the regiment.
What happened when you left Sandhurst? Did you go straight to a battalion of the regiment?
Yes. I left Sandhurst in August. July 36. One then got one's uniform together. Well, luckily, my father, a lot of his stuff fitted me, so it just had to be altered. And I reported to Tidworth in, I think, the end of September 36, which was the 1st Battalion.
What was the battalion actually doing when you arrived and joined them?
Firing its annual range course. To which one appeared, beautifully dressed. Our tartan trews were called musketry trews, and so you slithered about in the mud of Tidworth Ranges in these really rather expensive tartan trews, but I mean that was the way you did it, and you know, the field service jacket, battle dress had not come in then, and certainly no one paraded in denims. I mean, your denims were used to... purely for your fatigues and everything like that. And the battalion was under strength in some ways, supplying the 2nd Battalion, which was in India.
To what extent was it under strength? Could you give any...
Oh, I couldn't remember now.
What happened to you? Were you given a platoon straight away? Or
one was sort of put under instruction of... slightly older officer than yourself, the platoon sergeant, and you were sort of given a platoon, yes. But I mean, as I say, the whole time I was there was the whole business of getting the annual musketry course, which included, in those days, the Lewis gun, which was the light machine gun, which we fired. And it was quite a complicated course. And you did a lot of training for it, and then you went out on the ranges and shot. And a great deal of notice was taken of the scores.
What sort of targets were you shooting at? Were they all...
In those days, they were the normal bullseye targets with the little disc targets for snapshots.
Over what sort of distances?
What?
Over what sort of distances were you shooting?
200, 300 to 500 yards.
What did you think of the Lewis gun as a weapon?
I mean, it worked, it was bloody good, but it was an unhandy thing to carry about. It was definitely a great heavy affair. But it was a very accurate weapon when you fired it, because it was solid.
How did it compare to the Bren? Was the Bren
Bren was light years ahead. We didn't see our first Bren until 1939. We had a thing called the Vickers Berthier in between.
What were you doing when you were under instruction? Were you simply tagging along with the platoon and settling in?
No, not so. There was a special course for four of us young officers, which included a certain amount of tactics, a certain amount of what you might call easing into the regiment, and a certain amount of, how can I put it, dealing with life in an infantry regiment. So we were gradually eased into the system. I don't remember actually really commanding a platoon as such at Tidworth, and I wasn't there very long, because I was deported in January 1937.
Shipped out to India?
Yes.
You said you learned some tactics. What, did the tactics you were taught in the battalion differ in any way from what you've been doing earlier?
No.
So it sounds like it's a refresher.
No, this is what I would call the Aldershot Command, the sort of British Army type of going on.
And you said easing into the regiment. What did that involve doing? Could you say a bit more about that?
I was lucky, because of course I was born and bred into it, but if you came from outside, there were odd sort of customs and, how can you put it, ways of going about things that one had to learn. We had to learn Highland dancing. Dear me, we could be invited to some ball. You couldn't have someone dressed as an old girl making a nonsense of it, you see. That sort of thing. We were taught a bit about piping, to say we appreciated. It was just a question of, there's a modern word for it, and I can't think what the modern word is.
A tribal culture, perhaps.
Indeed, yes, but not quite that. Indoctrination, yeah.
And then you mentioned dealing with life in an infantry regiment. Was that the same kind of thing?
Well, I mean, yes, I had, but one had not come across the soldiers who made the sergeants and, you know, other ranks who made up the regiment quite to the same extent. And they wanted to get to know you. B, you wanted to get to know them.
And how did you get on with them on first acquaintance?
Oh, well, I was all right, because, I mean, they'd known me as a small boy. Very well. I think most people got on very well with them.
What sort of places did they come from? Did they come from a particular...
Well, mostly Forth Clyde Valley in those days. I would say that over 50% of our recruits came from the Glasgow area. You see, again, you've got to remember that in those days we had five territorial battalions who took off the country boys who didn't join the regular army. Why should they? They're much better off in the country.
And were they mainly on long service?
Yes, terms? yes.
How long did this process of settling in take?
Well...
Or was it not complete by the time you were deported?
Well, having joined sort of, you know, mid-October, really, 36, and being deported ashore on the 1st of January 1937 with a leave in between. There wasn't really very much time. And I mean, in those days, you see, the British Army in this country worked in a training cycle. And I arrived just at the end of one particular cycle, so I never really saw the whole works, as it were, in this army.
How was it that you were sent out so soon? Did you volunteer?
Well, no. A splendid character called the Thakur of Ipi started making a nuisance of himself, and he had to be suppressed. And our second battalion wanted reinforcements urgently, and so I and two others were sent out, especially to United States, especially as part of reinforcement.
Did you go out as part of a larger draft?
No, we had quite a, no. There were a whole lot of drafts on that particular ship. Yeah.
So you just went out as a small party of
officers? Yes, yes.
What route did you take to get out to India?
Through Suez, Southampton, Suez, Karachi.
Was this the first time you'd been abroad?
No, because I'd been in India with my family from 1921 to 1925 when I came home from prep school.
Could you remember what India was like?
Yes.
So you could anticipate.
Strange to relate, all sorts of interesting sort of things came back. You know, suddenly you remembered a bit of Urdu. You remembered all sorts of interesting things.
What happened after you arrived at Karachi? Did you go straight off to join the...
We were put in a troop train and arrived at Rawalpindi, which was 2.5 days' journey. And I was almost immediately put under arrest for having a dreadfully tight pokery around my toupee by my hat.
What happened to you when you were put under arrest?
No. I wasn't nothing like that. Nothing like that. But I was given this frightful rocket. My bloody tailor had got it wrong. I didn't quite know what they'd done. Anyway, it didn't matter. It was put right the next day by my own regimental tailor. In any case, I hardly ever wore the toupee again. It was one of those Wolseley helmets, by which time we were wearing the pith helmet.
Yes. So you got to Rawalpindi and you got a rocket from the Edison, which is a very suitable greeting for a newly arriving
subject. I mean, the Edison being an old friend, I mean, him and his family for years, our fathers have served together and all the rest of it.
So what happened after that, after the rocket?
One settled into one's quarters, and in that case, I was given a platoon. In India, British battalions worked on less officers because there were always, you see, after 3 years abroad, you realize 6 months leave at home. So there were quite a few of the more senior officers on leave. So it meant that us younger ones got on very much quicker.
You got responsibility earlier?
Oh, very much earlier.
Well, was your platoon up to strength?
Yes.
What was the strength at that time?
You had 2.75 of 5 guys and 3 sections of 8, I think there were. Mm-hmm. Plus, and then for the first time we had plus one mule. The mule carried your spare ammunition and water.
Did you know any of the chaps in your platoon? Had you ever
initially
met
no.
them before?
No. I'm not sure I hadn't met the sergeant before. I can't remember.
How long did it take you to establish a rapport with them?
Well, rather quicker than most, because we'd only been in Rawalpindi for a month before we were ordered up to the frontier. And so after the frontier, we went. And so you had to establish a rapport very quick.
Do you think that going into the field accelerates that process of
oh, yes.
building mutual trust?
Oh, yes, that's it.